Friday, 5 p.m. How does that sound, huh?
Double happy hour.
I'll say. Hope you're all doing well. Welcome to American Hit Radio on WHPC 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Tom Ryan. My lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales Ryan, here as well.
All the way live.
As we have been doing this now together for something like over 10 years.
Or a 12 long years, time. Like
a long time. And on Fridays, of course, we call the show How Music Changed, where we focus on specific artists and or events for a series of shows where we delve into their history and try to convey some sense of what was really happening behind the scenes and basically try to basically drum up the importance of these artists and what they had been meaning in the course of history. Well, right now, this is part 40 today in our series dedicated to the Rolling Stones.
Just never stops.
40 shows. You find them in the middle of the 80s with this show. 1986, to be exact, and probably at the nadir of what could have been their, you know, of their career up to this point. The things were getting bad for the Stones very quickly.
Again?
Which is sort of a drag. You know, it's amazing. It's just, one thing I learned from doing this history is that I just am so grateful that I was never in this band. There's so much that goes on, so much, you know, just strife and stress and disagreements and death and busts, arrests and illegal stuff and trying to make things work. And, it just seems like it was like, it's hard to believe that they were able to truly enjoy it.
That's rock and roll.
But at this point in time, you get the feeling that they're definitely not enjoying it. We're going to focus mainly today on the album Dirty Work, which is what came out in 1986. It was their 20th album to be released here in America. Came out in March of 1986, and it came out, I said, as if you remember last week's show, when we were playing the tracks from Undercover, you could hear how there was a distinct difference between what was happening on some of the songs versus others. Like, you could feel that Mick Jagger was doing an awful lot of writing on his own and trying to do an awful lot of production that had alienated Keith and the rest of the band. Well, in this case, things are a little bit different in the sense that Mick has decided that he's going to keep his best material because he's going to start a solo career.
Uh-huh.
Didn't go over too well. So by the time I'm going to be reading a lot of excerpts from Keith's autobiography, called Life, regarding this era and the opening track from the album in particular. By the time we gathered in Paris to record Dirty Work in 1985, the atmosphere was bad. The sessions had been delayed because Mick was working on his solo album, and now he was busy promoting it. Mick had come with barely any songs for us to work on. He'd used them up on his own record. And he was often just not there at the studio. So I began writing a lot more on my own for Dirty Work, different kinds of songs. The horrendous atmosphere in the studio affected everybody. Bill Wyman almost stopped turning up. Charlie flew back home. In retrospect, I see that the tracks were full of violence and menace. Had It With You, One Hit to the Body, Fight. We made a video of One Hit to the Body that more or less told the story. We nearly literally came to blows over and above our acting duties. Here's that opening track.
We'll be right back.
Well, the first thing that you can note, if you have been paying attention as we work our way through this, is that this album, at least that track, if it's representative, is much more guitar-centric than the previous album.
Yeah, you can tell that Keith is more involved, I guess.
Yeah, Keith's writing this stuff, and well, Keith writes on his guitar.
He needs to have the challenge. He needs to rise up to the occasion.
Well, I think he was really smarting by the fact that Mick did so much of Undercover and was so busy trying to basically sound like every other trend that he could possibly find and follow that Keith didn't really have any place for it. But here, with Mick really coming in with nothing, it was Keith's turn to step up. And Keith says, well, okay, I've got a bunch of riffs. And excuse me, and he would supply them and put them down. The fact is, though, that almost all of these tracks are put together without Mick Jagger even being present. A lot of times he wouldn't even show up for the sessions. So, for the most part, Jagger's vocal parts were added after the fact. So, I mean, fairly obvious, these sessions were done out of obligation more than out of any desire to really create music, which definitely affects the album.
Sure.
In terms of like what it was, you know, what it could have been. I mean, this was their very first album that they're recording with their new recording contract with CBS Records, which just began in April of 1985. So because they just signed a new deal, they had to put out this album. But I think that Keith felt that he was basically blindsided because he didn't realize that that deal that he signed for renewing everything with CBS also included the deal for Mick. And he didn't know it.
Should have gotten his lawyer to read it then, shouldn't he?
I guess he never expected that Mick would do that. So speaking about how lyrics come into play now because of the sense of betrayal, we can go to the next track up on the album. By the way, One Hit to the Body was a single. Went to number 28. It was the second single released from the album. But anyway, the second track on the album is a song called Fight. And as Keith says, it gives some idea of the brotherly love between the Glimmer Twins at this juncture. The lyrics go like this. Gonna pulp you to a mess of bruises, 'cause that's what you're looking for. There's a hole where your nose used to be. Gonna kick you out my door. Gotta get into a fight. Can't get out of it. Gotta get into a fight. Keith himself is saying, yeah, it's about Mick. Here's Fight.
Yeah.
fairly self-explanatory. And also, again, fairly obvious that Keith was the main driver on that song. For two reasons. Number one, I mean, not just the lyrics, but the fact that it's obviously guitar-centric.
Yes.
Much more so than the previous album, once again. And also the fact that Keith always really liked to play up-tempo songs, you know, thinking of themselves as a rock and roll band. Yeah. He always felt that that's where he wanted to stay. And in this way, he was trying to get back to his own roots, playing songs that still had a contemporary feel, but without being, without betraying what he felt were what was like the Rolling Stones' reason to exist.
Yeah, not being too trendy.
Right. So, unfortunately, the fact that they weren't a real band, there's just something about the feeling of these songs. Because you could say, you know what, they're good. But there's something about the way they feel that just makes them sort of fall flat. It might be the way that Jagger's delivering the vocal. It's hard to say. I mean, I could just be reading into it. But I just get the feeling that, you know, sometimes the way that somebody feels when they're recording a song is reflected in the sessions. And if you're unhappy, it's somehow going to come out in the music. And
or just not dedicated.
Right, right. Where the best ideas might not even happen because you're not discussing it. You're not working out the material to really kick it to the next level. That's probably the best way to put it. That's probably exactly what it is. Well, there was a single, the first single from the album, which went into the top 10. Sort of ironic that they would choose a cover song as their first single.
Well, they did a lot of cover songs in their career.
Oh, yeah. But at this point in time, they were doing most of their own writing. There's very few tracks on this album. I think this is the only one that was a hit for somebody else. How long ago? Maybe 15 years earlier? Sometime like before the Beatles, I think, is when the original Harlem Shuffle came out.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So the Stones basically dug up the track, covered it, and released it, and like as I said, went to number 5. Here is the 45 version of Closer.
Take it close. Again, I'll take the liberty of reading into it a little bit, and I'm going to guess that that song was probably brought in by Mick Jagger. And I think that the reason there would be that because he didn't have a little material of his own to bring in, that he probably decided it would be a good idea to do a cover song. And the production on the track also sounds like something Jagger would do with all the really heavy synth parts in the background on that song.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I'm not going to play this whole album. I'm going to skip a couple tracks as we go through it because it's a bit spotty. But there's enough to play, more than enough to play. But I'm going to read a little bit from Keith, again, out of his book called Life, regarding the situation with Mick. I used to love to hang with Mick, but I haven't gone to his dressing room in, I don't think, 20 years. Sometimes I miss my friend. Where the hell did he go? I know that when things hit the fan, I can guarantee he'll be there for me, as I would be for him, because that's beyond any contention. I think over the years, Mick has become more and more isolated. I can understand it in a way. I try and avoid isolating myself, but even so, you often need to insulate yourself from what's going on. In recent years, if I ever watch an interview with Mick, at the base of it, he's going, "What do you want out of me?" A defensive charm comes on. What do they want from you? They want some answers, obviously, to some questions. But what are you so scared of giving away? Or is it just the act of giving away something for free? And you can imagine how, if you were Mick at that time, in his high days, everybody wanted a piece and how difficult it was. But his way of dealing with it was that he would start to slowly treat everybody that defensive way. Not just strangers, but his best friends. Until it came to the point where I would say something to him and I could tell from that look in his eyes that he was wondering, what's Keith's game? And I didn't have one. The siege mentality builds up. Now you've built the wall, but can you get out? Just when he was at his most insufferable, a bombshell was dropped onto our assembled gathering. In 1983, we were a growing concern. There was a multi-record deal with CBS and its president, Walter Yetnikoff, for $20-odd million. Well, what I didn't know until a good while later was that on the back of that deal, Mick had made his own deal with CBS for 3 solo records for millions of dollars without a word to anybody in the band.
That's nice.
I don't care who you are. You don't piggyback on a Rolling Stones deal. Mick felt free to do that. It was total disregard for the band, and I'd rather have found out about it before it went down. I was incensed. We didn't build this band up to stab each other in the back. It became clear how much earlier the plans had been laid. Mick was the big star, and Yetnikoff and others were fully behind the idea of him taking off on a solo career, all of which flattered Mick and encouraged his takeover plans. In fact, Yetnikoff let it be known later that everyone at CBS was thinking that Mick could be as big as Michael Jackson, and they were actively promoting it. And Mick was going along with it. So the real purpose of the Rolling Stones deal was for Mick to ride in on top of it. I thought it was just a dumb move, basically. He didn't realize that by doing something else, he was breaking up a certain image in the public mind that is very fragile. Mick was in a unique position as lead singer of the Stones, and he should have read a little more into what that actually meant. Anybody can get big-headed once in a while and think, I can do this with any old band, but obviously he proved it's not true. I can understand somebody wanting to kick the traces. I like to play with other people and do something else. But in his case, he had nothing really in mind except being Mick Jagger without the Rolling Stones. The way it was done was just so tacky. I could have maybe understood it if the Stones were flopping, like the rat leaving the sinking ship. But the fact is, the Stones were doing very well, and all we had to do was keep it together. Instead of losing 4 or 5 years in the wilderness and then having to pull it all together again. Everybody felt betrayed. What happened to the friendship? You couldn't have told me from the beginning that he was thinking of doing something else. Meanwhile, Keith, obviously, who had spent a great deal of time in Jamaica and was doing the heavy work on this album, brought in a reggae song, called it Too Rude. Here's that track.
Realize walk so proud. Come down from off my cloud. How can I live my life this way? A beauteous day on me and the face. Ain't that the truth? Ain't that the truth?
It's really funny how when you get on a theme like this that you can read into every single song title. Like, you can definitely tell that the first track, Too Rude, the Jamaican dub song, was really exclusively Keith. And right. That track, Winning Ugly, very much Mick. And the fact that it's called Winning Ugly, you can't help but think, like, in a way that I just wonder if it was subconscious. Like, he must have felt that way.
Maybe.
That he was, like, somehow winning ugly by, you know, getting the contract in the back door and starting his solo career. Well, the band wasn't happy, but, I mean, just listening to Keith's comments are so stinging. Just before we play the title track of this album, let me read a few more of Keith's primo comments. Mick's album was called She's the Boss, which said it all. I've never listened to the entire thing all the way through. Who has?
Ouch.
He goes, it's like Mein Kampf. Everybody has a copy, but nobody listens to it. No matter what Mick's doing or what his intentions are, I'm not sitting around festering, nurturing venom. My attention, anyways, was turned suddenly and forcibly in December 1975 to the shattering news that Ian Stewart had died. He died of a heart attack, aged 47. I was waiting for him that afternoon in Blake's Hotel, off the Fulham Road. He was going to meet me after he'd seen his doctor. Around 3 in the morning, I got a call from Charlie. Are you still waiting for Stu? I said yes. Well, he's not coming, was Charlie's way of breaking the news. The wake was held at his golf course at Leatherhead, Surrey. He'd have appreciated the joke that this was the only way he'd ever get us there. We played a tribute gig to Stu at the 100 Club, the first time we'd been on stage together in 4 years. Stu was the hardest hit I had ever had, apart from my son dying. At first, you're anesthetized. You go on as if he's still there. And he did remain there, turning up one way or another for a very long time. He still does. The things that go through your mind are the things that make you laugh, that keep you close, like his jutting-jawed way of speaking. So the Stones lost. Really, the man who was responsible for bringing them together.
Right.
Back in the early days. Right in the middle of this, and at their worst period, it's a shame that Ian Stewart wouldn't have gotten to know that they actually were able to overcome these differences. But meanwhile, here's the title track from the album. Here's Dirty Work.
Get away from me.
it's telling, even though the Stones, most of these songs are original, that a large number of the songwriting credits now had third names attached to the Jagger-Richard duo. Like Jagger-Richards Wood on one track, Jagger-Richards Chuck Lavelle on another. There's only three songs that are credited to Jagger-Richards on the album, which
so
was the lowest.
Not writing as much together.
Right. That's the lowest number of, you know, Jagger-Richard credits on any album, going all the way back to their cover days in the early 60s. So, just about through the album. Let's see. What's the lyrics to this song again? This is Keith again. About the next track called Had It With You. It's amazing when you can just feel the venom on every song. Every song. I love you dirty, fill in the blank. Sister and a brother, moaning in the moonlight, singing for your supper. Because I had it with you. It's such a sad thing to watch a good love die. I've had it up to here, babe. I've got to say goodbye. Because I've had it with you. That was the kind of mood I was in. I wrote Had It With You in Ronnie's front room in Chiswick, right on the banks of the Thames. We were waiting to go back to Paris, but the weather was so dodgy that we were stranded until the Dover ferry started rolling again. There was no heating, and the only way to keep warm was to turn on the amps. I don't think I'd ever written a song before in which I realized, in the moment, that I was actually singing about Mick. Here's Had It With You. Keith liked to write the rockers.
Yes, he did.
No doubt about it. Now, in doing so, what Keith was doing deliberately, consciously, was he was writing
this as many songs as he could on the album. He's writing pretty much all of them that he was in charge of writing, trying to structure them so that they could all be played live, because he expected to tour in support of the album.
Right.
Before he got word that Mick decided he wasn't going to tour at all.
Nice.
Now, Mick later had cited a legitimate cause for it. He said that he was actually, you know, didn't want to tour because Charlie's health wasn't good, which at this point in time, Charlie was suffering from pretty severe heroin addiction.
Oh, really?
It was his turn.
Oh, lovely.
And so at this point in time, in fact, a lot of the drums on the track, on a lot of the tracks, are not Charlie. I would think that was Charlie on that song. It sounded a lot like him. But elsewhere, there's a lot of other drummers that are brought in. But anyway, as Keith says in his own book, Dirty Work came out in early 1986, and I badly wanted to tour with it. So, of course, did the other band members, who wanted to work. But Mick sent us a letter saying he wouldn't tour. He wanted to get on with his solo career. Soon after the letter came, I read in one of the English tabloids of Mick saying the Rolling Stones are a millstone around my neck.
Ooh.
He actually said it. Swallow that one. I had no doubt that some part of his mind was thinking that, but saying it is another thing. That's when World War III was declared. What Keith means by that, this is when he decided that he would pursue his own solo projects. Obviously, you know, his first one was when he decided to team up with Chuck Berry. He had wanted to get in touch first. He knew that he wanted, especially, I guess, because Stu had passed away. He started thinking of Chuck Berry's piano player, Johnny Johnson,
mm-hmm.
and figured maybe we could do some work with him, which, of course, led to him beginning to work with Chuck Berry. And then that led to the project which became Hell, Hell, Rock and Roll. So Keith
that was
said,
a fun thing, a nice diversion.
So while Mick was pursuing a solo career, that was Keith saying, I'll do whatever I want to do, too. I'm not going to have to worry about you. It also, so that was his first solo project, which I think was an excellent success, quite an artistic success, and commercially as well. And then he started to pursue a solo album called Talk is Cheap. So Keith was saying he was just going to sit around and lick his wounds.
Right.
He stayed busy. Well, here's how the album closed with a song called Sleep Tonight.
Sympathy, baby, yeah. You better get
And so it ends, except for a small 30-second coda that they put on at the end of the album of Ian Stewart playing a boogie-woogie piano part.
Oh.
They would just give him a 30-second bit at the end of the record, which was nice but also really sad because you figured that they could have made a bigger statement than that considering how important he was to the band. And it just makes you think that if only they would stop, shut up, stop bickering and play, they could be great. Because you can see that there's some strength here, but like I said, it didn't come together on this album. I'll point it out right now because I want to play two rare B-sides from this time. Really, quite rare, actually. Apparently, they were deemed grossly non-commercial for the mid-80s, which is why they were basically dumped on the back of some 12-inch mixes and stuff like that. It's the only way that they ever came out. It's interesting because I loved these two songs. That was the best thing that they had done in maybe 15 years. It shows you just how great the band could be if they would only keep their music blues-centric, in my mind. At the time, after hearing these tracks, I remember thinking that if they did this more often,
they'd be at the top of their game.
Yeah, and they stood a good chance of growing old gracefully and maybe even becoming like elder statesmen. Just
well,
like,
you can tell by the songs that are very mix-centric. They have like they have not aged well. They have cheesy, schlocky keyboard stuff happening. And
so keep that in mind as you listen to these to this track now, because I honestly think that if they followed this path, they could have become like elder statesmen, just like their heroes at Chess Records. With that, like they could literally be doing this now and they would sound fantastic. The first song that I want to point out how great they could really could were in 86 is this track called Fancy Man Blues.
Thank you.
Man, I'm not sure if you agree with me, but to me, I mean, that's just great blues. And this is at a time in the mid-80s when we were starving for something like this. With all the synthesized stuff that was happening, the Stones...
God, you didn't have real drums, you didn't have real anything.
This is like, yeah, this is just real great music, and they could have stood for something. This next track makes my point even better. I'll leave you with this one other fantastic blues track by the Stones that they made in the mid to late 80s. And we'll be back next Friday, folks. Hope you can join us. Meanwhile, check this out. Here's the Stones doing Cook, Cook Blues.
Bye.